Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents. And there are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. 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 Family, thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and as always, in studio with me today, the shining star in our sky, Mr. Kyle Filson. Philly, my friend, how's it going, Brad?
I am doing excellent, man. I'm feeling good. My allergies have cleared up. A couple storms have rolled in. Right? Seem to move all that pollen and stuff out. Yeah, I feel good.
The blowing cloud of death. My voice is a little shaky. Kyle's voice. We'll touch on that at the end of the show. We'll tell you what happened.
Yeah, my voice is shot.
Yeah. We had a very interesting
evening.
This weekend was really, really amazing. For those that follow on Instagram and Facebook and all that, you've seen what happened. We'll discuss more of that in the outro. But right now, there's something that happened a few days ago, and I have to talk about this.
I saw this. Several of our listeners, when I say several, like 40 to 50,
yeah, right,
sent me this, and so I knew that we were going to bring it up at some point.
Okay.
Pretty cool.
You know how we're all consumed with the idea of the Hobbit of Florence and whatnot, and what they had found in Micronesia and all along that. For those that aren't aware, they have some video. Now, it's on some different websites, but there's a video footage of it on YouTube, and it looks more like a GoPro camera on some motocross riders. Looks like some guys riding the dirt bikes out in Indonesia. And what it says is they believe that they caught a member of an Indonesia's lost pygmy tribe run across the trail in front of them. It says a mysterious half-naked tribesman was seen running down a dirt track in Indonesia by a group of bikers. Now, where it was at was in this Banda Aceh, and that's the northern tip of Sumatra. Now, the fella does appear to be carrying a large stick, and they use the term half-naked, which I don't look. He looks like he's got on a loincloth of some sort. It's hard to see. He's very small. And when I say small, I mean like he's not like just a normal thin guy or a four-footer. We're talking like a dude like around 3 foot, 3.5 foot. It's strange, but he was spotted in that northern tip of the island of Sumatra. And it says that some of the viewers of this guessed that I wonder if this was a member of this mythical Mantee tribe. Now,
which was once a real tribe.
It
could be because
a very real tribe that dwelt deep in the forest.
In my opinion, he was either a leftover remnant of that or it was a child. It's not, like you said, it's not the clearest of footage, but
yeah.
It's not someone who suffers from, I guess, dwarfism. I don't know. Because the thing is running fast.
He looks proportional.
Yeah, they're trying to catch it on a dirt bike and are having a little bit of a hard time, so.
It looks like he hops out in the video in front of someone, boom. And I'll tell you what this article says. The footage shows one of the bikers falling on the ground as this mystery figure runs away from the group. One of the bikers continues down the track in pursuit of this skittish man who jumps into the bushes by the side of the road. So what ends up happening is, and the reason I don't think it's a child is because it doesn't look like it's built like a child. It looks like you can see muscles in its back and stuff that you wouldn't normally see on a child.
I agree.
And it looks almost bald. I would say, like, you know how they shave the top of their head and then the hair is like a ring around it? Like, you've seen those tribesmen like that. It almost looks like that. It's either that or he's totally bald and he's got something on his head, or it's hard to tell. But so they stop. One of the guys, like I said, falls over. They look around. They see the guy running. They gas it like they're going to catch up with him. About the time the bike gets there, he jumps to the left and just into the thick brush and truly vanishes. Of course, it's very high. Like, we're talking the grass is probably 6 foot, you know. Story goes on that these motorcyclists there go into the bushes and they start trying to find this tribesman. And they said they went and they find the large stick he's carrying. They found this. So that's when they were like, oh, it's part of the pygmy tribe. Well, the Mantee tribe are actually smaller than the average men. And they also have been said that they would flee when they would see people from the outside that weren't like them. There's a record of this alleged tribe, or supposedly, from the 17th century. And it claimed that these Mantee tribesmen were captured and presented to the Sultan. And so that's how this whole thing got started, these little fellas. Well, like we talked about in the island of Flores in 2003 was whenever they found those hobbit remains of what you know, we call all the hobbit. 3.5 foot tall folks that they said they knew lived around.
These were real.
These are real people. They dated it back to 50,000 years ago, but then they also brought it back to what was it? 10,000 years ago that they know they were alive?
Yes.
So could there be a group that's still out there hidden in this part? I mean, if you brushed it off, how often would you go looking? So that's why they were talking about this. So the video was released March 22nd. So that's what got everybody looking. People really went to really going wild and digging into this whole thing. So it's like, okay, you would think that there would be other tribesmen, other people would take it serious. Maybe there's other people know about them. Things, we don't know that. So I got to looking around and I'm like, well, there's got to be something a little bit closer as far as seriousness to it. Well, just so you know, this past Thursday, on the 30th of March, the governor of that area, and I would love to pronounce his name to y'all, but there's like three names. It's this whole thing's crazy, but his name is Zaini. And he said that he formed a team to investigate the possible existence of the Mantee tribe. So he'd talked to some other elders in these other villages around there. He went and had some people talk to them. And they had told some tales of them coming in contact. So that made him decide this. And it says a team has been formed to launch an investigation because it relates to the rich history of the AC's area there. And that he told this reporter, this Tempo, this past Thursday, that they were going to go and start doing investigations, that he is putting together a group of people that's they're like a cultural investigation group. And, you know, you can go out and all these guys have got survival guys with them and all that they are going to start right in there around where that track was, where that sighting was. They're going to take the reports of some other sightings. They're going to narrow down some hot spots and they're going to go and start looking. They're going to go and see if they can find any, you know, any tracks, any remains, anything that they can basically trace down to where these people come from and if they're really there.
That's going to be incredible.
How wild is it?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's fun to see that they're finally getting people behind them, that they're like, all right, you know, look, you think about the Orang Pendek. Now, we've talked about that as being the little hairy creature. Well, that's kind of what they call these, is the Orang something or other. I'm not even sure. I can't remember where I'd read the last. But that's kind of along those lines, is if we know these are out there and we know that this is the next thing, is if you don't want to be found, it would be hard to be located, especially given that much terrain and as rough as it is. And if you lived off the land, like for us, I couldn't take you up in the woods and just drop you off and say, now don't let us find you in a year, because it's going to be hard. But if generation after generation of your family was born and raised hiding from those people, it wouldn't be that hard to do. It's not something like you're intentionally trying to do. It's the way you live your life.
I agree.
So with that, man, I hope they find something out. Well, I take that back. Let me rephrase this. I hope that they would come to a realization that, okay, we don't need all that proof. It's they're there. just leave them alone.
Right.
Because you know what's going to happen. We're going to get in there, and I say we're just the people, modern society, modern people are going to get in there. Not me and Kyle. We're not going to. There might be malaria. I don't need that. So they're going to go over there, and we're going to do like we do with all these other lost tribes. Next thing you're going to be knowing, they're going to be wearing Nike shorts. They're going to be suffering from some sort of disease.
Some guy with a Wu-Tang t-shirt.
Exactly.
They don't need it.
You don't need all of that. But I do like the idea that there is at least real interest. What is it about that government? Remember, they've made the whole park area for the Orang Pendek. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like they're open-minded. What is it about them that's different than anywhere else?
Because they're not trying to profit off of land or what they can, resources they can rape the land over there.
It seems like that's what it's got to be, right?
That's what it seems like to me.
Something along those lines. But anyhow, so I saw that and I'm like, man, we got to discuss it. I urge you folks to check out the video. You watch the video, it's kind of wild when you see it. You're like, what am I looking at?
Yeah, I'll put links to it in the show notes. Recently, a fan of ours and a website that we support, Phantoms and Monsters, Lon Strickler over there, has an amazing website. If you're into that kind of thing, I suggest you go over there and check it out. He recently posted this weird encounter someone had of a flying cryptid, and of course it takes place in West Virginia. For whatever reason, West Virginia seems to be a hotbed for whether it's Mothman or these winged creatures. And this is what the letter says. It says, "Hello, sir. I wish to report something I witnessed on March 17th near my home. I live in a rural area in Cabell County, West Virginia. I am a widow. And I moved to this house last September in 2016 from Ohio, and I live currently with my daughter. Not long after we moved in, we began to hear loud flapping sounds coming from the river across the road from my property. The sounds would usually occur at night. We also saw bright orange lights through the trees near the river. Now, one afternoon, I walked across the road and looked around, but I couldn't find anything out of the ordinary. The sounds and the lights continued all winter. In fact, one evening, while it was snowing, the flapping sounds were very loud. I watched from my living room window as a bright orange light quickly moved upstream, then downstream above the river. Then on Friday, March 17th, I was on my front porch and heard a loud squawk come from the direction of the river. I looked that way and I saw a huge bird-like something rise above the trees. It was early evening, but it was silhouetted against the sky. It looked like it stopped in mid-flight, stretched its wings, and hovered in mid-air. It had bright orange lights or eyes, and it seemed to stare and radiate at me. It was terrifying and menacing. I ran into the house and called for my daughter, who was down in the basement. We looked out the window, but it was gone. Now, we haven't heard any sounds or seen lights in the area for 2 weeks since my sighting. Do you think you can tell me what I saw, JL?
Nope. Nope, I can't tell you.
Now, Lon said he emailed JL and then called her, and she stated that the creature resembled, get this, Cam, a huge wasp, and it hovered like a flying insect. It said the thin body was tapered and the wings were solid. He said he went on and asked her if it was shaped like a butterfly or more like a moth, and she acknowledged that it had a similar outline, but only two large wings. She estimated that the wingspan was between 10 and 12 feet, and that the body was about 4 feet tall. There was no head, but the bright orange eyes were positioned within the body. It was dark in color, and the wings were more rounded and solid as compared to a butterfly or moth. She also noticed that there were several thin arm-like things sticking out from the mid-body. The witness sounded quite rational, but she also sounded truly worried that this creature might return. She swears that it looked directly at her, leaving her with a feeling of foreboding and fear, and she estimates that she was only about 40 yards from it. So he said, he goes on to say that, you know, we asked her to keep in contact with her and please respond to him and report any unusual activity if there's anything else going around the house. She did acknowledge that the house is spiritually active and that at least three times she's seen shadow beings there. And but there haven't been any other disturbances recently since the winter is over.
Mm-hmm.
But what is she seeing? A giant wasp-like thing? And why are there so many flying cryptids seen in the great state of West Virginia?
First of all, a giant... Oh, it's one thing to see a flying humanoid. You know, if you came across something and had an encounter like that, that's one thing. But why does this flying human have to be a giant wasp?
I don't know.
It makes me think of, what was that on the movie Ant-Man? The Yellow Jacket.
Yeah.
Remember the Yellow Jacket? Yep, that was, you know, the one that that was the other guy's suit. It makes me think of something along those lines.
Creepy.
How creepy would that be? But what would you mistaken that for?
I don't have an answer.
You know what I mean? It's like, what was it? Oh, it was a goose in flight. You're like, wait.
Hovering in midair with glowing orange eyes? Yeah. No, sir. No.
Exactly.
I don't know, man. That's why I find this stuff interesting.
I love it. I love that kind of story because it makes your mind race.
Yeah.
Well, I'll get you something that you're not going to love, Kyle. Japan. This is from TheVerge.com.
I like Japan.
Yeah. I love Japan. And it takes a big step toward widespread drone delivery service.
I even like them more now.
It says that Japan, perhaps more than any nation on Earth, has a deep history with autonomous drones. Its companies have been using them, it says here, for decades to assist with agriculture, infrastructure inspection, and construction. And that this weekend, one of Japan's biggest tech companies, Rakuten, announced it was forming a joint venture with the American startup AirMap, and that the goal is to develop a robust traffic management system for unmanned aerial vehicles, allowing large numbers of drones to operate autonomously in the same airspace. Rakuten, which is best known as an e-commerce company, has been experimenting with drone delivery service since June of last year. And much like Amazon, it wants to enable customers to order something online and have it delivered to their doorstep or windowsill in under an hour, Philly.
Wow, that's awesome.
That's rocking, right? And it says that the company sees low-altitude airspace as a wide-open market, where the only competition comes from birds and radio waves. And AirMap recently disclosed a $26 million round of funding led by Microsoft Ventures.
That's awesome.
That the company is using the cash to open new offices in California and Germany and is already planning for the day when its mapping technology could be used to help a variety of different autonomous vehicles navigate, they say, safely through low-altitude airspace, and that includes flying cars.
Right on.
So it goes the low. Look, that's one thing that we always think about, and you and I, we've brought it up. If you have a flying car, you get too high, then you're really going to be dangerous. Whereas if it was 50 foot off the ground, and then it was all talking to itself, you know, and everything zips around and moves around, it would be much, much simpler. And I wouldn't say safer, but it would be much simpler. So now you have these drones. I think it's going to happen, but I think the drone delivery thing is something we're going to see happening very quickly. And I don't think it's going to be limited to companies like Amazon. I think we're going to see it in food delivery. I think we're going to see it in grocery delivery. I mean, like we talk about, if it's an older couple, not even a handicapped couple, you're so busy you couldn't go to the store, or your wife, or, you know, whatever, your husband, nobody can make it to the store. You place an order. I mean, I know they do it in Walmart and other grocery stores now. You order online, pull up, and they're ready. Your groceries are, you know, tagged right and bagged and ready to roll. Now, how about it gets delivered?
Yeah.
You know, and of course, it is going to be something where they have larger drones. My only concern is the noise pollution level.
Right, just constantly hearing the sky.
And not just for, you know, but for wildlife. Right.
I never thought about that till just now, but I remember distinctly when 9/11 happened. Remember, they stopped all air traffic.
The silence.
I didn't know how quiet it was until those two or three days where there was no air traffic. Because we live just outside of Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Well, Dallas-Fort Worth has one of the largest international airports around. There's constantly jets in the air. Not just that, there's Carswell Air Force Base and now a Naval Air Station, so there's fighter jets around here all the time. Those couple days, I remember, it was really eerily quiet. So you're right. With all these drones in the air, how much louder is it going to be? Whether there's highways, there's drones.
I think that's where there's going to be. Well, they talk about the autonomous, this mapping I was just discussing.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be something to where it's a law that we don't notice. You know, it's like we make changes and we're faster than our laws. We're faster than things. I think that's coming because you're going to have to be where, like, you can't take it over hospitals. You can't go around. You can't have this constant buzzing of sound. And like I said, not just us. You couldn't do it over livestock. You couldn't do it over, right, you know, there's the wildlife's going to suffer. I think there's a lot of issues that we've yet to think about when it comes to flying drones on the reg, not just a handful, hundreds of them in the sky, like a cloud of birds.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be an issue that we're going to have to deal with that.
I think you're right. When it comes to the sky, folks, that's what I'm going to be talking about today after the break. I'm going to be talking about one of Australia's most famous UFO abduction cases, the case of Frederick Valentich. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to expanded perspectives. In one of Australia's most famous cases of alien abduction, Frederick Valentich was an Australian pilot who disappeared on October 21, 1978. His disappearance is surrounded by mystery, controversy, and skepticism. For years now, people have wondered what happened to him and his plane. You see, on that fateful night in October, Valentich, then only 20 years old, was flying his small Cessna airplane 125 miles from Australia to King Island when he encountered what he claimed to be a large, unidentified flying object. Over a radio communication with a Melbourne tower, he claimed the mysterious object was playing games with him, and only a few minutes after that, all communication was lost. No one would ever speak with Frederick Valentich again. So, did he somehow lose control of his aircraft? Was there some kind of mechanical malfunction? Was it simply pilot error? Or did something else happen? Many believe that he was abducted by alien beings. His father seemed to believe that, and always believed that one day, the aliens would bring him back. In Australia's most famous case of alien abduction, Valentich's lost flight is how the very reason the Bass Strait Triangle got its nickname. Valentich was a pretty average Australian kid. His dream was to become a professional pilot. He, like many others, applied to the Royal Australian Air Force twice and then settled for the Air Training Corps. He was studying part-time to become a commercial pilot, but struggled with the examinations. He had a private pilot's license with about 150 total hours flying time and had completed his night rating. The boy was enthralled with UFOs and the idea of an alien invasion. Shortly before he disappeared, Valentich claimed that he had seen a flying saucer once, moving very fast away from him. His father said that his son was very worried about what would happen if the extraterrestrials ever attacked planet Earth. On the night in question, it was a sunny evening on the 21st of October in 1978 when Valentich booked a training flight in VHDSJ, a rental Cessna 182 light aircraft at Moorabbin Airport near Melbourne. The weather forecast was good. He filed a flight plan for a trip to King Island, one of the islands of Tasmania. The Bass Strait lies between Victoria and Tasmania, and pilots always try to reduce the amount of flying time over the water. So rather than fly straight across the strait from Melbourne, Valentich's route would have taken him southwest along the coast to Cape Otway, to then cross the strait to King Island, making it an 85 kilometer or 50 mile stretch across the open water. Following the standard route from Moorabbin Airport to King Island Airport, it's a 90 minute flight. It's not clear why Valentich was going to King Island. He told his family and his girlfriend that he was going there to pick up some crayfish. At Moorabbin, he said that he was going to bring some friends back and took four life jackets with him for the return flight. He'd mentioned to his girlfriend that he'd be back by 7:30 p.m., clearly not possible with a 6 p.m. departure. Another odd detail was that he didn't phone King Island Airport to tell them that he was inbound to them. You see, the small airfield is uncontrolled, and there would be no one there after sunset. He couldn't land there unless he called to ask them to turn the runway lights on. Clearly, he wasn't thinking, or was planning something else altogether. Or was it just a simple oversight, a massive oversight, one that possibly cost him his life. He had the fuel to go there and back without stopping. The round-trip journey was about 235 kilometers, or 145 miles, and would take about 3 hours in the Cessna, well within its range. There was no danger, just that he was embarking on a pointless journey. It was simply odd, especially in combination with his unclear plans, and could imply that he had no intention of going to King Island that evening. He might have been up to something nefarious, something like smuggling along the coast. Maybe he wanted to be alone in the dark to look for UFOs and just didn't want to admit it on a flight plan. All we know for sure is that he never made a phone call to have the runway lights turned on. At 6:10, VHDSJ was refueled to capacity, giving it 300 minutes of flight time. At 6:19, Valentich departed Moorabbin Airport and flew southwest as per his flight plan. At 6:43, the sun set. Valentich was flying in the dusk over the water. Night flying requires a separate rating for visual flights in Australia because it can become disorienting. Flying at night over water is especially difficult, as the lack of lights means that there is no way of orienting yourself to the ground. So as the sunlight faded, Valentich would have seen a sky full of stars above and darkness below. At 7 p.m., Valentich contacted Melbourne Air Traffic Control and gave his location as over Cape Otway on the south coast of Victoria. Cape Otway has a lighthouse, which makes it an easy visual reference point. He confirmed that he was proceeding to King Island. His flight plan showed that he would remain below 5,000 feet and that he had estimated it would take him 41 minutes to fly to Cape Otway, and then a further 28 minutes from Cape Otway to King Island. He was right on schedule. Valentich identifies himself by the final letters of the call sign of the aircraft, VHDSJ. Melbourne Flight Service Unit uses this call sign to make it clear who they're speaking to, and when used on its own, simply to acknowledge that the controller has understood what the pilot said.
Melbourne, this is Delta Sierra Juliet. Is there any known traffic below 5,000?
Delta Sierra Juliet, no known traffic.
Delta Sierra Juliet, I am. Seems to be a large aircraft below 5,000.
Delta Sierra Juliet, what type of aircraft is it?
Delta Sierra Juliet, I cannot confirm. It's far bright, but seems to me like landing lights.
The obvious first question is, what did Valentich see out there in the dark? After the event, some people believe there was nothing there at all. There were rumors that the whole thing was simply a hoax and that Valentich was having a laugh before purposely disappearing. But he had no reason to go, and all of the evidence points to the fact that Valentich truly believed in extraterrestrial spacecraft. The air traffic controller said afterwards that he was convinced that it wasn't a joke. He was sure that Valentich saw something.
Melbourne, this is Delta Sierra Juliet. The aircraft has just passed over me, at least 1,000 feet above.
Delta Sierra Juliet, roger. And is it a large aircraft? Confirm?
Unknown. Due to the speed it's traveling, is there any Air Force aircraft in the vicinity?
Delta Sierra Juliet, no known aircraft in the vicinity.
It's possible that the lights were another aircraft, small enough not to show up on Melbourne's radar, but it seems to be traveling too fast for that, unless it was military. There were no reports of military aircraft in the area. Meanwhile, there were a number of reports of UFOs that night. Mount Stromlo Observatory advised that the night of the 21st was the peak of a meteorite storm, and they recorded 10 to 15 meteorite sightings per hour. The uptick of UFO sightings was expected. In fact, studies show that 29% of UFO reports are actually the result of bright stars and planets, and a further 9% are explained by meteors. The UFO sightings that night
were almost certainly reactions to the meteorite storm. A meteorite might also explain a fast-moving craft in the sky. However, the meteorite storm doesn't explain the four clear lights that Valentich reported over him.
Melbourne, it's approaching now from due east towards me.
Delta Sierra Juliet.
Delta Sierra Juliet, it seems to me that he's playing some sort of game. He's flying over me two, three times at a time at speeds I could not identify.
Delta Sierra Juliet, roger. What is your actual level?
My level is 4,500. 4500.
Delta Sierra Juliet, you confirm you cannot identify the aircraft? Over.
Affirmative.
Delta Sierra Juliet, roger. Stand by.
Melbourne, Delta Sierra Juliet. It's not an aircraft. It is...
Delta Sierra Juliet, can you describe, the aircraft?
Delta Sierra Juliet, as it's flying past me, it's a long shape. Cannot identify more than that. It has such speed. Before me, right now, Melbourne.
Some of what he saw could be explained by fast-moving meteorites out of the corner of his eyes. However, that doesn't account for a hovering aircraft directly above him. James McGaha and Joel Nickel of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry believe that they know what he saw. As it happens, a computer search for the sky of the day and time and place of Valentich's flight reveals that the four points of bright light he would almost certainly have seen were the following: Venus, which was at its very brightest, Mars, Mercury, and the bright star Antares. These four lights would have represented a diamond shape, given the well-known tendency of viewers to connect the dots, and so could well have been perceived as another aircraft or even a UFO. In fact, the striking conjunction was shaped as a vertically elongated diamond, thus explaining Valentich's saying of the UFO that it has a long shape.
Delta Sierra, Juliet, roger. And how large would the object be?
Delta Sierra, Juliet, Melbourne. It seems like it's a stationary. What I'm doing right now is orbiting, and the thing is just orbiting on top of me. Also, it's got a green light and a sort of metallic light. It's all shiny on the outside.
It's not clear what Valentich might have meant when he said that he was orbiting. Possibly that he was flying in a holding pattern or in order to get a better look at the object. What's absolutely clear is that his entire attention is taken by the unidentified flying object. The mention of the green light is new.
Delta Sierra Juliet? It's just vanished.
Delta Sierra Juliet, come in.
Melbourne, would you know what kind of aircraft I've got? Is it a military aircraft?
That wasn't really a conversation that he needed to be holding right at that moment, but Valentich's curiosity was piqued.
Delta Sierra Juliet, confirm that the aircraft, it just vanished?
Say again?
Delta Sierra Juliet, is the aircraft still with you?
Delta Sierra Juliet, it's, no. Now approaching from the southwest.
There's a dangerous configuration that has killed many pilots, especially visual pilots who have not been trained to fly by instruments. It's known as the graveyard spiral, or suicide spiral, and is common in poor weather conditions and at night. The spiral is caused by well-known sensory illusions that affect us while we're in aircraft. The pilot becomes disoriented and loses the ability to judge the orientation of the plane. He believes he is flying straight, with the wings level, but in fact, he is pulling the yoke slightly, leading the aircraft into a bank. The aircraft then starts to fly in a large circle, and if the pilot does not recognize the situation, the plane will begin a gentle spiral towards the ground. For example, a pilot who enters a banking turn to the left will initially have a sensation of a turn in that same direction. If the left turn continues, say 20 seconds or more, the pilot will experience the sensation that the airplane is no longer turning to the left. At this point, if the pilot attempts to level the wings, this action will produce a sensation that the airplane is turning and the banking in the opposite direction, or to the right. If the pilot believes the illusion of a right turn, which can be very compelling, he or she will re-enter the original left turn in an attempt to counteract the sensation of a right turn. If the pilot fails to recognize the illusion and does not level the wings, the airplane will continue turning left and losing altitude. The graveyard spiral is initiated by an unintentional turn or a return to level flight after an intentional prolonged turn. Basically, you get disoriented and put the plane into a slight bank. Now that feels straight and level to you. So if you then correct the turn, you feel like you're doing turning, so you don't. And the plane very slowly and gently flies in circles that increasingly get tighter as the aircraft descends. Valentich said that he was orbiting, and the thing was just orbiting on top of him. So he probably was in a low, slow turn. He did not have much experience at night flights and only had the most basic instrument training. It was dark, and he was flying over water, with no horizon to help him orient himself. He initially saw four white lights, but then mentions a green light. His right wingtip happened to have a green light on it, a navigation light. What he's seeing points to an aircraft that is not flying straight and level. It's slowly spiraling down.
Delta Sierra Juliet, the engine is rough idling. I've got it set at 23, 24, and the thing is coughing.
Delta Sierra Juliet, roger. What are your intentions?
My intentions are to go to King Island. Melbourne, that strange aircraft is hovering on top of me again. It's hovering, and it's not an aircraft.
His engine is running rough, but instead of wondering why this is, he's still staring out the window at the UFO. Even when asked directly what his intentions are, he doesn't consider breaking off the water, crossing as a result of engine trouble. The rough engine coughing certainly sounds like a fuel issue. If he's flying in a tightening spiral or even upside down, that will decrease the fuel flow, leading to exactly those symptoms. What Valentich needs to do right now is stop watching his UFO and fly the plane.
Delta Sierra Juliet, Melbourne?
There were no further transmissions. Melbourne declared a search and rescue alert immediately, and at 8:33, when Valentich did not arrive at King Island, an intensive air, sea, and land search started. They scoured the area for 4 days, but were unable to find any trace of the aircraft. 5 years later, an engine cowl flap was discovered on the Flinders Island, washed in from the sea. It was positively identified as coming from a Cessna 182, of the same batch as the rental aircraft that Valentich was flying. No other trace was ever found. Frederick Valentich's father joined the Victoria UFO Research Center and continued to hope that his son was alive and abducted by aliens until his death in the year 2000. And yet, there's strong evidence that the young man's belief in the extraterrestrials actually led to his death. It appears that what should have been a brief distraction became a tragic event. So at this point, I decided to call a close friend of mine, an amazing researcher and colleague, a true brood, Mr. Micah Hanks. Now, if you don't know, or if you're new to the show, Micah Hanks is a writer, a researcher, podcaster, lecturer, and a radio personality. He's written several books, including Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, The UFO Singularity, and The Ghost Rockets. He's the host of The Graylin Report and Middle Theory, and an overall great guy.
Brud.
Hey, Brud. How's it going?
Going good. Going good. Getting by. Living the dream.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah? What's going on down there in Skeleton Studios?
Oh, you know, work is normal. Work is normal.
Yeah.
How about you? You been busy?
Oh, God, yeah. There is never an end to the busyness.
Well, I hate to bother you, Micah, but I know that you know some things about this story. And I believe I heard you talking one time that you actually spoke with Frederick's girlfriend. Is that correct?
Well, first and foremost about that, you think that calling me to talk about a famous UFO case is bothering me? What about all the other times that you call me?
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I try to keep it down, but I'm just very interested in this.
No, I am too. I have been for a long time. And, you know, speaking of calls, I did get an opportunity to speak at length on one occasion with Rhonda Rushton, who had been Frederick Valentich's girlfriend at the time. And, you know, Rhonda and I, we stayed in touch, in fact. I mean, she's a wonderful person, and I hope to get down to Australia at some point to meet with her and some of my friends in the ufological community down there. And after that experience, can you imagine what it would be like going through something like that, where someone close to you, your girlfriend or your spouse or a family member, just vanishes? And let me give you a little bit of like a background.
Sure.
About my personal interest in that, because that kind of leads up to how I came into contact with Rhonda and became friends with her, and how I eventually hope to get down there and stay with her and her husband Joe and just hang out and go over some of her personal documents about all this. That case, I think, was first brought to my attention maybe by Stanton Friedman. I mean, about a decade ago, and I'd been talking with him one evening over the telephone, and he had brought up Valentich, and I familiarized myself with the case, and of course, like a lot of people, I was just amazed by this idea that a plane disappeared in conjunction with a UFO sighting. But Kyle, like over the years, I've kind of tried to back away from that whole, oh, it was a UFO case, one of the most well-documented UFO cases of all time. And I look at it almost more in the context of being a missing person case, because, I mean, damn, not only did the pilot go missing and his craft, but it was never located. And there so happened to be this strange anomalous light that he described, some sort of an object. So I think you might know about this. And our pal Soraya on his Where Did the Road Go podcast, he's actually, you know, played this song that I wrote about this thing called Never Without You. And it was loosely inspired by the whole Valentich disappearance.
Wait a minute. You wrote a song about this?
Yeah, I did. If you haven't heard it, I mean, I've got it on my website, and you can find it on YouTube too, but it's called Never Without You. And I actually wrote a song that's loosely inspired by this idea. And here's the whole story behind that. I was digging through. See, there was an Australian researcher a few years ago who had managed to get the complete government, Australian government's investigation into the Valentich disappearance. The documents had been kind of quietly released along with a bunch of other files that were just kind of batch released. And he had managed to discover this PDF on the website in question from the division, whatever agency. I think it was the Aviation Authority. And so when this came out, it was like big news. And Red Pill Junkie, of course, he sent me a copy and says, man, I've read the entire thing already. You need to also. And I did. And there was this really kind of poignant moment where, according to Rhonda, and you got to keep in mind, at the time of his disappearance, she was only 16, and she had asked him if he could get on board a UFO aircraft. Would he, if one landed right in front of him and he could just take a buzz on a flying saucer? And his response to her was, well, I would if I could take you with me, but never without you. And so I wrote this song called Never Without You that was loosely inspired by that. Fast forward to about 3 years ago. I got an email from one of our Australian listeners, and this fella had said, you know, I work with Freddie's girlfriend at the time, and she would really like to talk to you. And I'm thinking, okay, Freddie. And I remember reading this email, Kyle, like, you know, late at night.
Right.
And got up the next morning. I usually don't go back and reread an email like that, but this one, there was something in my mind that just, I was like, no, what was that email about? You know, and because you know how it is. I've been down there with you in the studio. When you work late at night and you're sitting there, you know, you're having a dad juice and you're just kind of hanging out, you know, yeah. And just, you know, you can kind of be in your own element. And I got up the next morning, put my ears on, put my brain back in my head, you know, and I'm looking at this email and I'm thinking, Freddie's girlfriend, Rhonda. Frederick. And he was talking about Rhonda Rushton. So he arranged for us to get in touch, and we Skyped It was evening on my end, and it was morning where she was, she and her husband Joe in Australia. And we spoke for maybe about 2 hours. Some of the things, yeah. And talk about poignant. I mean, at one point, she mentioned the song, Kyle, and said it's a lovely song. And I'm just
she had heard the song too. Wow, that's incredible.
She had heard the song because she familiarized herself with me, and she even listens to my show now. At that point, you know, she was kind of getting to know who I was, because one of my other listeners who worked with her said, look, you got to check out this guy, Micah Hanks. He does this podcast, and he talks about this case quite often, because at that time, I mean, I was really fascinated with it. So she had heard the song, and all I could say was, well, my God, I mean, it's for you. So imagine that. As we're sitting there talking, though, she told me some interesting things about that case that, you know, either have not been really discussed or have not really been public knowledge. And of course, I asked her, I said, do you mind if I talk about some of this? And later that same year, I ended up giving a lecture. One of the interesting things that had happened was she had said that the people there with the aviation authority who had interviewed her, it was more like an interrogation. I mean, she said it's like something you see in the movies. I went into this dark room. I'm sitting there and they're asking questions because they really wanted to know from all the family members. I mean, did this guy actually disappear, or has he just, you know, disappeared himself? Is he in hiding? Was he engaged in some sort of illicit activity? I mean, all possibilities were being explored. And so Rhonda, being, you know, again, just, you know, in her late teens, she's kind of like, man, this is just crazy. And she said a couple of years later, she was in a, I think she said it was in a Kohl's, and she said that a gentleman came up to her and said, you're Rhonda Rushton, I remember you. And she didn't remember him. And he said, well, I had been a part of the group of people who had been interviewing you back when your boyfriend disappeared. And she told him that he made reference to the recording. And it's known that there was a recording of the famous, the transcript's all that's available publicly. But, I mean, there was a recording, obviously, that air traffic control in Melbourne had made of the communication between Freddie and air traffic controllers.
Right,
As he was flying south over the Bass Strait. And I think that Guido, his father, had been given a copy of that. And then there were two MUFON investigators in America that got it too. But the thing that the guy from the authority said was that he said, you know, on that recording, it's interesting because after the – and he – again, I asked for clarification on what I'm about to tell you. And Rhonda said, yes, that's how I took what he said as well. He seemed to tell her that where the transcription ends with Valentich saying you know, there's an object above me that's hovering. It's hovering, and it's not an aircraft. And then there's 14 seconds of metallic scraping and all this. He seemed to indicate that after that, there was at least some continued dialogue that was not included on the edited tapes. And I say edited tapes because when the tapes were released to the family and the two MUFON investigators were able to conduct their analysis, it was referred to by the authorities who released the tapes as an edited tape.
Now, that's bizarre.
That's very bizarre. They didn't go into detail about why exactly the tape had been edited or what parts had been edited. If something had been removed, if they had trimmed it, you know, just for sake of brevity, who knows? So that was one of the mysteries. Another strange thing, though, that happened had been that the family, Guido, his father, I think specifically, they had written their own book about what life was like after Freddie vanished. He was never found again, keep in mind. The book at some point was stolen from their house, and they do not know by whom. And I mean, there were just all these really bizarre things that Rhonda talked about. But one of the most interesting things you got to keep in mind, you remember like Philip J. Class, the UFO debunker?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So he had taken a big interest in that case too, Kyle. And one of the speculative threads that he had followed was that Freddie either had a girlfriend down there on King Island that he was sneaking off to go see, or that he was running drugs.
Right.
And I asked Rhonda some questions about the flight. One of the things that I'd been interested in knowing was, you know, according to the flight log, he seemed to have left at a time much later than the stated time he had planned to leave. And I said, you know, why in the world that wouldn't match? And he said, well, I can tell you that the night that he flew to King Island, he was trying to get in some night hours because he had a flight exam upcoming. And I often flew with him, she told me. And she said, I was supposed to fly with him that night, but I worked at a chemist at the time, which we'd call a drugstore here in the States. And she said, I was supposed to be flying with him that night, but the problem was that I didn't get off work in time. And so I called my mom and I said, can you guys, is there any way you can give me a ride to the airport? I got to meet Freddie. And they said, no, We've already got plans for the evening. Well, they didn't have cell phones back in those days, right, and so right. She didn't have any way to contact him there at the airport. And so he apparently waited and waited as long as he could. And then finally, after assuming that she wasn't going to be there, he decided to make that famous and presumably fatal flight by himself. So she was not only supposed to be on that flight with him, but that explains presumably why he left later than his flight log had stated he would. And what's...
That makes sense, because that was one of the mysteries, is why he left later.
Yeah. And she said, I mean, yeah, he... In fact, I mean, she and... I've got a lot of friends down in Australia, UFO researchers who have contributed to the... the trying to piece together the final hours of Frederick Valentich. You know, what did he do before that flight? There are so many details known to the friends and family in the UFO community, right down to him going to McDonald's before he flew, which is interesting because, again, it was their anniversary. It was like their 3 or 4 month anniversary, I believe. And Rhonda said, I had initially planned to fly with him. He was just going to fly down to King Island. He was going to come back. We were going to go out to dinner that night. If he had been flying off to see a girlfriend, or if he'd been flying off to, smuggle drugs or something like these ridiculous claims made by certain debunkers, he wouldn't have probably been bringing his girlfriend along to meet the other girl. Right. Again, she and, of course, the family were questioned about the whole drug thing. And Rhonda said, look, trust me, even if I hadn't known his father, I think they would have found out if Freddie had been up to anything illicit. The documents released, by the Australian government also referred to him. And I actually quoted Rhonda, I believe, as saying that Freddie was a quote-unquote not a Friday night type. They tried to, draw this picture of this emotionally troubled, dark, quiet, brooding individual who might have been suicidal,
The government did.
Yeah, in the document. And they even quote Rhonda. I asked her about some of those quotes, and she said, these are all things I said, but she said, I read that report, and she said, I think they completely mischaracterized what I had said. They picked and they choose certain things to try and build this narrative that made it sound like he was depressed and possibly suicidal. She said, look, he loved to go dancing. He was really chic. He would dress really well. She said that he was really popular. He'd come in. He was extremely friendly, and if he came in to see her at work, he would talk with all her employers and employees, or the other, the fellow employees, and so he was just a really friendly, likable person, and that the document, again, making him out to be this, again, not only a depressed loner, not a Friday night type, but also this guy who was a UFO true believer. Apparently he had read Chariots of the Gods, and so people say this guy was into UFOs, which is extremely suspicious. You got to figure, at that time, 1978, that was a pretty popular book. It had already been around for a decade, I believe.
Yeah, I believe it was a bestseller at the time. Why wouldn't you be interested in it?
Well, it was a bestseller, and that's the whole point, is whether or not one is particularly a UFO nut. Somebody like you and I, we might have read more of these kind of books than the average person. Freddie, he had read one of the most popular books at the time on that, but then again, a lot of people who may not go to UFO conferences or listen to UFO podcasts have probably read Chariots of the Gods. I own a copy of it, and I don't believe a word of it, but,
right.
But that's the thing, is and I've said this before, whether or not you agree with Von Daniken and the ancient alien theory, the progression of thought that led to this idea of ancient astronauts, which he, in modern times, is largely responsible for kind of establishing that in the meme sphere. Again, the cultural significance of what he's done is important to understand nonetheless, so... Anyway, I think Freddie probably read it because it was a popular book. And I asked Rhonda specifically, was he really into UFOs? Had he read a lot of UFO books? Her response to me asking that was, not really. He wasn't particularly. I think that was the actual word she said. Not particularly is how she said it.
Wow.
And, yeah. So, again, the skeptics saying, this guy's a UFO true believer. He was possibly suicidal. All these kind of things. Again, they are painting a picture based on an individual that they did not know. And I asked Rhonda, I said, you having known him arguably better than most, did any of these skeptics contact you and interview you? And she said, not a one.
Really?
So,
from speaking with her, what do you think her final thoughts were on the crash? Does she think that just Freddie had made a pilot error or misjudgment, got disoriented and crashed in the ocean? Or does she think something truly otherworldly happened to him? What did she think? Because I know his father continued to say that he thought that his son was abducted, and he hoped that one day they would bring him back before he died in the year 2000.
Yeah, that is true. Guido did believe that that Freddie... that's a difficult thing, because I think that any father or mother, anyone who's had a child, right, their child goes missing, they're going to try and hold out hope. And as far out as the idea of a UFO abduction of an entire aircraft might seem to, the non-believer. I make that point because, again, I have tried to come away myself from just being like, oh, this is a UFO case. And I look at it more like, okay, a person vanished and so did his aircraft and something unusual was happening. And in this rare instance, rather than just the typical aircraft disappearance with the Valentich case, come hither, boy, come hither. My producer just arrived, comes sneaking into the house like this. But anyway, in this instance, again, I think that, the father, he was coping with this in the only way that he could. He probably believed in some UFO phenomena himself, and I'm sure that he kind of looked at this whole thing and is saying, yeah, you're damn right, I hope the aliens came and got him, and maybe they'll bring him back one day.
Right.
As far as Rhonda's feeling about all that, though, Kyle, it was this kind of a thing where, I think that she's a lot like me in the way that she thinks about things, in that she tries to suspend judgment because we just don't know. I mean, she too has often said, I'd love to think that it was aliens or something, because that might mean that he didn't, crash into the ocean. But as far as what skeptics have said about him possibly flying upside down and things like that, she said, I'd flown with him maybe 30 times in various aircraft. She said, we would do loop-de-loops. He would do all kinds of tricks. And yeah, many times we flew upside down. And she said, to your question, because I asked her specifically about that, and she said, to your question, what it feels like when you're flying upside down. And so the idea that he'd been flying upside down and that the lights on top of the cockpit had illuminated the water beneath him and that he mistook that for being an aircraft above him, she said, I didn't buy that, because even as it was getting dark when he disappeared, he would have, I think, been aware. He was experienced enough a pilot to have been able to probably discern that he had been flying upside down. But, I mean, again, I think that Rhonda kind of keeps an open mind. And we don't know what happened to Freddie. I think that we would all like to know. But, again, since 1978, there's been a lot of conjecture, a lot of speculation, official investigations. All we know is that there was never a plane found, and he described something that seemed extremely anomalous as he was in the act of disappearing. And in this rare instance, unlike a lot of these cases, we have this recording, which only a few people have heard, but the transcript of the recording, what known portions exist, is publicly available. And anyone can go online and read that, and we know what he described and of course, how he described it.
Wow. Well, thank you for taking your time to talk to me today. Man, you're the man. I know you're a busy guy, so thanks for reaching out to me and speaking with me today about it. You be careful out there.
Always a pleasure. I'll have to get back down to Skeleton Studios pretty soon here, Brud.
You know you will.
Well, after talking with Micah, I have to admit, I'm a little torn about this story. If it truly were a hoax, and Freddy's plane simply crashed into the ocean because of being disoriented, then why the whole smear campaign? Why would the Australian government go through all of the trouble to paint Frederick as a UFO junkie, a true believer, and even perhaps a nefarious drug smuggler? Why were the transmission tape recordings altered and edited? Certainly his father didn't believe it was a simple crash. His girlfriend, even today, doesn't believe it. Something strange was going on. Also, if he were faking his own death, for what reason? I think something strange really did happen to Frederick Valentich that night. Something otherworldly. Something unexplainable. And I believe that a few individuals know what truly happened that fateful night. But in the end, it's for you to decide. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. This is a strange story. Mm-hmm. Cam, you've been well aware mm-hmm. of it for a while. I've talked several times before, and I'm glad I know I've talked to Micah about it before, and I'm so glad I was able to call him on the phone and talk to him on today's show about it. It's one of those things where you like read all the clues and you read the transcripts and things, and you think, you know, like you were talking about, it seems like he just had pilot error. He was inexperienced pilot, especially at night. You can become disoriented. We talked about the spiral condition where you can lose track of the horizon because of being at night. Mm-hmm. And if you're not really proficient with instruments and stuff, you can become confused. And that probably is what caused him to crash. But then, of course, during the phone call conversation with Micah Hanks, his girlfriend starts talking about how he wasn't obsessed with UFOs and that the Australian government seemed to be going out of its way to discredit it, to discredit him, to make him look like he was a loose cannon, that he could have been smuggling drugs, all these things. So if it truly was just a crash, these planes crash all the time. In fact, a close friend of ours that used to hunt with us died in a plane crash just a couple years ago.
Yeah.
You know, these types of things, especially small Cessnas, I think they happen all over the place all the time. The government didn't swoop in to try to cover up that case. So what is it that made this case different? And why was the government so concerned about covering something up if it truly was just a plane crash? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Man, it's one of those, like you said, there's a lot of speculation on this whole thing. It's easy to say because of his age.
20. He was 20 years old at the time.
It's easy to say that it was pilot error. I don't know how much, you know, I don't know how many hours he had into it. Not that I'm any, some sort of.
Like 150 hours or something.
You know, like what, you know, I don't know anything about it. You know, I've never flown a plane. You know, it's one of those things. I've never done it. I've never even thought about getting a pilot's license. So I don't know if you learn enough. I mean, I know I don't have to have 150 hours to drive a car, you know, so that's the whole thing. So it's one of those, I don't know if 150 hours is enough, not enough. I have no idea. So could there be human error? Yeah, I think there could be. And I understand the way they are talking about, well, they're seeing some lights on the wings and maybe that's what he's seeing and all that. But to me, that almost seems too simple of an explanation. And I understand the whole Occam's razor thing. I get that. And I understand that that would be the easiest deal. And if you were already a little disoriented and you were already panicky and the things that maybe you're not in your right state of mind. And you're, I mean, look, I know God only knows I made horrible decisions at the age of 20. I make bad decisions at the age of 41. So it's not like it goes away just because you're older.
Right.
But some of the things that he said just doesn't lead me to believe. I guess it's this. I'll equate it to a car. If you had no lights inside your car, okay, and nothing, and you're driving through a pasture at the night and you had a green light on your hood, and you were talking to me on the phone, you wouldn't tell me that there's a green light in front of you that's tracking with you.
I wouldn't think so.
There's a green light on my hood.
I wouldn't think so.
You would have seen it. If he spent, was this the first time he flew at night? No, it was not the first time he flew at night, correct?
It was not.
So he's seen that light before.
Yeah, only a handful of times, yeah, though.
But he's seen it before.
But that's what I'm saying is when you just become disoriented, though, you're confused. So yeah. I know it seems simple, but it may not be that simple.
I just don't know. You know what I mean? It's one of those things because it's, I don't know. I can't commit to it. I don't understand why they, like you said, there's like some sort of cover up to it. What's going on? Was it something? Was he in the wrong place at the wrong time? Did something happen? I want to believe that that's all it. Well, we know he crashed.
No, he's never been seen again.
Exactly. I mean, we know it. So it's not like, but we don't know what caused the crash. So I guess, I don't know.
Lots of there. Some people think he didn't crash and that he faked his own death and then he lived the rest of his life or he's living somewhere else right now.
Man, she would have to really be a pain in the butt to make you fake your own death, wouldn't she?
Well, I don't think he was even dating her that long. 3 or 4 months?
Well, then she had a serious impact on him.
She was supposed to go with him that day. I don't know. There's a lot. And then the airstrip where he was supposed to land, it was just a very small airstrip.
Yeah.
They said that you're supposed to call ahead. If you knew he was traveling there at night, you're supposed to call ahead and have him turn on the runway lights because there's no one there. He didn't do that.
Yeah.
So if he planned on landing there, why was there no phone call?
Yeah.
It's truly,
there's a lot of parts of this story that make zero sense.
Yeah. I agree.
Just make no sense. And maybe, you know what? Like we talked about, my son, he's late. From times whenever I try to get him to do stuff, you know, they just do. Maybe that was all it. Maybe he just he didn't call ahead. He was just a little arrogant. Maybe
it happens.
Exactly. When you're a young man, that testosterone's flowing. You're not afraid of anything. And then you go down in the ocean. You crash.
And I mean, unfortunately, right, sometimes just a slip of the mind can end up doing you in at one point or another.
Yeah.
Very cool. Before we get out of here, I'd like to mention our sponsor, Gaia.com. That's GAIA.com/EP. And don't forget, folks, if you want to support us, you got to support our sponsors. If you go over to Gaia, it's a video streaming service. It's an awesome video streaming service. It's like Netflix or Hulu. They have thousands of videos over there, yoga, how-to things, and some very interesting things when it comes to the subject of UFOs, conspiracy theories, ancient cultures, and ancient history. Things like Cosmic Disclosure with David Wilcock. That's very interesting. Don't forget about Buzzsaw. What's the other one? It's Beyond Belief with George Norrie. And Truth Hunter with Linda Moulton Howe. And, of course, my favorite series over there is Deep Space. I love Deep Space. It's like 11 episodes over there. And it's talking about the ancient alien theory, along with how secret societies and our governments have been working in conjunction with these secret space programs, and by reverse engineering stuff that has crashed here on the planet, they've been able to come up with this awesome technology. I love that series. And if you go over there, you can get a couple of them for free, and you need to check that out. If you decide to go with Gaia, if you sign up now, it's about $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents. They also have a three-month plan and an annual plan. Of course, the larger the plan you pick, the cheaper it gets. But not only are there those interesting shows that are on there, there's all kinds of documentaries, man, on all types of things. I think you're going to enjoy it. We would never sponsor something that me and Cam both personally would not endorse. That's Gaia.com/EP. Cam?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
It was quite an interesting weekend we had. We mentioned it in the beginning of the show.
Yeah, to say the least.
You want to tell everybody what we did? It was a really rare type of thing, something we don't normally do.
Well,
in fact, it's the first time we've ever done it.
It's the first. Exactly. It's the first for us. A good friend, more like family of ours, Mr. Logan Huffman, is an actor and all that. And, of course, for those of you that keep up with music, his fiancée is Miss Lisa Veronica of the group The Veronicas. And Logan had reached out to us a while back, and there's been some photos we posted a while back. And when we had went over in Dallas, they were filming a movie here. And so Logan had come down to do his part and film it. And we went, and we all went to Dealey Plaza. And, I mean, the people that follow had seen us over there and gone on. Well, the movie had wrapped up, had finished. Got all put together, and he sends us a message. He's like, hey, look, I'm going to be in Dallas. Lisa and I are coming down. Come over. Come to the film release. Me and Kyle's like, wow, a film festival release. Like, dude, we've never done that. Like, we're in. We're down. So we go over there. It's at the Magnolia Theater in Dallas. It was an amazing evening. And you're asking right now, what movie did you see? It's called Bomb City, folks. I urge everybody. I think Logan did it to us on purpose. We didn't really know what it was about. Kyle and I had both heard the stories of what had happened, but it's about a boy named Brian Dennehy. And you can do your research. It's all based on a true story about how, the jocks and the preps of the high school in that area was kind of clashing with the punk rock movement in Amarillo, Texas, back in the 1990s. And it all went down in 1997. And it didn't have a good outcome, and it's still not a good outcome, but it's a very moving film. And Kyle and I sat and watched that film with Logan and Lisa and the rest of the crew, and a lot of other people were there to watch it. And then the Q&A afterwards, they had the cast and crew get up, and they're answering it. And then they brought up Brian, the deceased boy's parents, and they were sitting right in front of us.
Yeah, like literally like the row in front of us.
And they stand up, and it was all we could do not to just break out in tears, because it is a very, very moving film. And, of course, everybody's clapping. And like,
it's a true story. It's incredible.
It's and we met some of the best people. The people involved in the movie, the boy that played Brian's name's Dave Davis. We met and hung out with Dave. Of course, we got to hang out with a boy in the movie that plays Cody Cates. His name's Luke Shelton. He's a big part of it. We got to hang out with him. Of course, we know we're hanging out with Logan. He's like a brother now. And then, of course, the beautiful Miss Lisa Veronica. She sat right there with us. We all hung out. We talked. We got to meet, one of the producers of it, Major Dodge. We also got to meet a girl. This was the greatest thing. The people that you run into. Run into a Louisiana, a Cajun fella by the name of Isaiah Laborde. He does a bunch of stuff on sci-fi. He was parts of this. It was great. He did a great job. It was just awesome. And then there's a young girl that was there named Rachel Brooke Smith. She's been on a ton of sci-fi movies. She was in that. She was hanging. We talked to all these people. We found out more about movie making and the stuff that goes on. We had our minds blown. That's right, folks. Us two morons hanging out with all these folks. like a duck out of water while we're sitting over there. We're like, hey, what's going on? We learned so much. We got to meet. Everybody was so wonderful, so kind. Everybody there. So we had a wonderful time.
Yeah, it was pretty cool, man.
It was awesome. But
to see how that world works.
Yes.
It's something I've never been included in. And I was thinking that to myself, even when there was a bunch of people taking a group photo of all of us and we were there. I was like, they're going to be like, who are these two idiots photobombing this?
Yeah, exactly.
Because we look totally out of place.
We don't fit in. Y'all know
that. But that's normal
that.
For me. I look out of place everywhere. That's why I hide inside this studio. It's got like cushioned walls.
Ain't that the truth?
And some computers. This is where I live.
You're not allowed to leave here. Yeah, we're going to have to keep. So we had a great time. So that's why our voices are shot, because we went to a restaurant and we were having a few drinks and eating and everybody's talking and there's a restaurant. And I'm sure you have been there too, folks. When they play too loud of music.
In the restaurant?
In the restaurant.
Yeah.
And I got to yell. And people already getting in. So everybody's yelling over one another. And it was just, it's one of those deals, you know. And it just, I don't understand why they got to make loud music. And let's all just hang out. I don't have to do all that. But anyway.
We'll tell you other ways to support this movie as it gets further along, as it gains more traction. Because there's a lot of information that we don't know. This was the first time it was ever shown in front of an audience.
Yeah.
Ever. And so it's going to be touring, going to different film festivals. We'll know more as, we'll tell you more as we find out more.
For sure.
Excellent weekend. Don't forget, folks, if you have sightings or stories you'd like to share with the show, you can email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call the show 817-945-3828. You can follow us on all forms of social media, and we'll be talking again to you elite members on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll be talking to you again on Monday for Pretty Lights, Gaia, The Black Angels, Phantoms and Monsters, Inner Tradition Books, New Page Books, Llewellyn Books, Anomalous Books, and Ancient American Magazine. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Much love from Texas, y'all. Peace.